Hello, joining you on Friday, December the 12th, as we inch mercifully closer to those blessed days when we no longer have to read about hibernating, untrained pro cyclists, sickeningly good running times, and also no longer serve their equally unwatchable golf swing videos on Instagram. My name is Daniel Freeman. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will divert, not avert, our gaze towards the Southern Mediterranean, where almost the entirety of the pro peloton has taken up residence before Christmas, as per the annual tradition. This will, in fact, be the first of two consecutive special bulletins from December Costa Crawl of Spanish training camps. Uniquely, historically, I think, both episodes, this week and next, will feature only journalists with the first name, Daniel. At the weekend, we'll dispatch Daniel Arribas, he of our Vuelta coverage in September, to report on UAE and Pogacar. Well, this week we've got a new voice on the podcast, but a name most of you will be familiar with. His Substack is to professional cycling transfers what the Daily Mail is to British royal family drama. Oh, he's already upset. He is Daniel Benson. Daniel, how are you doing?
I was fine.
Why are you so affronted by that?
I was fine until the Royal Mail, Daily Mail correspondent reference. But yeah, I'm fine. Other than that, all good.
Listen. What I'm saying is that you are the ultimate
Give it another go. The only
authority, really, on professional cycling transfers. I didn't want to go down the Fabrizio Romano route. That was the obvious one. Fabrizio Romano, famous Italian tweeter who tweets all of the football transfer news. You do that. You do for cycling what he does for football. But that is true, I think.
People said far worse, so I'll take it.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, you are, as we've already established, you're in Spain. I'm not sure what part of Spain. I don't think you're on or in Mallorca any longer because you're done with Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. That's going to be the main topic of conversation today for us. But I think you're heading to another training camp on the mainland later today. Is that right?
Yeah, we did first couple of days in Mallorca, all focused on Red Bull. And then yesterday, hopped on a flight to Alicante. And later on this afternoon, we've got Lidl Trek. And tomorrow, we've got UAE Team Emirates XRG. I'm actually in the Soudal Quickstep Hotel right now. And I wasn't expecting...
You're snooping.
Yeah, I'm not snooping. I'm just using their better Wi-Fi. I'm staying just on the outskirts of town, and the Wi-Fi is terrible. So for this podcast, I went to Soudal, having quick coffee with a couple of people here, and as luck would happen, it is awash with cycling agents in the lobby this morning. I'm not sure why, but there's about three or four I call big hitters hanging around, so hopefully get some news
big
out of them.
Hitters. Who are the big hitters among the cycling agents?
There's too many to name.
But... Who's the biggest hitter these days?
Carrera.
Who's the biggest hitter?
Alex Carrera. I mean, if you look at just the sheer volume and the quality of his riders, like Gamay, Pogacar, of course, Philipsen, Van Giels, just to name a few. I mean, yeah, he's probably the biggest in terms of high-profile riders, for sure.
On a typical day, which of these the big fishes among the agents? What's the sort of if I opened your WhatsApp?
Oh God, okay. Yeah.
Generally speaking, which one is the richest seam of information? Some of them, of course, never give us any information, do they? Some of them probably. In very professional fashion, some of the agents are very, very tight-lipped and others are slightly more loose-lipped, shall we say.
That's a fair assessment. I'm looking through my WhatsApps now just to let you know. And yeah, I definitely can't go into that. So yeah, I don't know.
Well, Dan, maybe later in the episode when everyone's turned off, we'll go into the mechanics of how some of your stories come together. But there's a big transfer... Possibly, potentially, sounds like it, breaking transfer story down there, probably just up the road from where you currently are, because Picnic Post NL are one of the teams. All of the teams are there. Let's face it, I mean, this was another thing that I was going to mention at the start of today's episode. Dan, you've been in this game almost as long as me, probably going back to the days when teams were sort of split between various locations. There used to be, so... Early in the 2000s, there used to be a big contingent of teams down sort of in Tuscany, southern Tuscany, going towards Rome in Italy. And then around about 2010, the sort of balance of power started to switch towards the Spanish Costa, particularly the Costa Blanca or the coast south of Valencia. And now, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but every single World Tour team will be there at some point or is already there.
Yeah, pretty much. There might be like the odd exception in the sense that, well, I mean, I don't know.
Apart from Mallorca, which we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Mallorca, and then I'm not sure where EF are. They were in Girona last month, like November. They are going to have a second camp in January. I'm not entirely sure on the location, but I don't think it's Calpe. But what is funny about these trips is, like, you know, like you said, being on them for so many years, and you end up going to these hotels and you're like, the Red Bull Hotel, for example. Like, I know that HDC stayed there like 10, 15 years ago. And just down the road where I'm staying at the moment in Calpe, it's Groupama, FDJ and Total are in there. And previously, Garmin Slipstream or Quickstep. Quickstep were there. I think maybe even one year Lotto, Marc Sargeant's team. So there's lots of kind of similarities, but also lots of differences. But yeah, right now Calpe, it is a massive hotbed for team camps and teams. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, they're difficult to envisage how that's going to change. Particularly, I mean, no one's going to go back to Italy any point soon, particularly with the condition of the roads there. That's one notable reason why teams go where they go. But also, hotels in Spain at this time of year are pretty cheap, pretty advantageous for the teams, and the roads are excellent. But Dan, I started talking about Picnic Post NL. They're at the centre of some transfer speculation. Oscar Onley is the man at the centre of that speculation. You, as always, have been right sort of at the forefront of this story on breaking the various developments. And, well, it's gathered momentum again. This was something that was already talked about around about Tour de France time, when Onley was on his way to finishing fourth in the Tour de France. Mm-hmm. And then again at the end of the season, then it went a little bit quiet and it's resurfaced. Plus, on December the 10th, so 2 days ago, the UCI announced who was going to make up the World Tour in 2026, which teams had three-year licenses. And there was a bit of a surprising footnote in that Picnic have only been given a license provisionally, for 1 year rather than three. And the reason for this is financial. So we infer from that the team is struggling somewhat financially. What might this mean for the Onley situation? Well, we know that he has a contract for two more years. So if he was to be bought out, then presumably there'll be some financial penalty, transfer fee, if you will, paid by whoever is the buyer. Now, we think the buyer is probably going to be Ineos Grenadiers. What's the latest, Dan?
Very latest is, and I think we might even see news today on it, official news today, is that it's going to happen. I think it's very, very close to being announced that Onley goes to Ineos Grenadiers for 2026. What I don't know is if everything has been signed off. But what I understand as of now is that all the fundamentals for the potential deal have been agreed, and parties are confident, certain parties, not all parties give me information, I should add, but certain parties are confident that it will go ahead and Oscar Onley will be an Ineos Grenadier rider for 2026. Obviously, when I say it hasn't been signed, that's the final piece in the puzzle, but is fundamentally also the most important. So for whatever reason, there could be a hitch, I don't think there'll be a change of mind from the athlete's point of view, but there could be a change of mind from either other party involved, and it has to be a three-way party agreement, of course, as per the UCI stipulations and rules. But right now, if I was to write a headline and it had to go out in the next 35 minutes or whatever, I would be saying that the deal is imminent.
Dan, how these deals work, I mean, they're becoming more and more common because we get more and more long-term contracts in cycling. So every year now, there are big-name riders who are bought out of contracts. And maybe in our ignorance or naivety, what we usually imagine happens in these cases, or we maybe assume what happens, is that whatever the value is of the remaining years on the contract, that is essentially more or less the fee that is paid to release the rider from their contract. I don't know whether that's right in every case. I suspect in some cases it's probably incorrect. In this instance, Onley has two more years left at Picnic, but we don't think that he's on a particularly highly paid contract currently. And I've seen figures, I think I saw in the Dutch press, I don't know if you've reported any of these figures, but I've heard speculation about €7 million to buy him out of the last 2 years on his Picnic contract.
I've not heard or seen the like the official figures in terms of what.
Well,
there won't be any official figures.
We'll never find out, will we?
No, that's true. But I mean, I wouldn't at this stage be printing figures from just on the information that I have. But what I do know is that obviously he signed his contract well before his breakthrough Tour de France. Pitnick, with all due respect to them, are not in the same financial leagues as the bigger teams in terms of paying riders. So he's definitely, I would say, undervalued. And also, I think going back to the previous question, I think a really telling point is the fact that he didn't sign a contract extension. You know, you look at Lipovic, for example, at Red Bull, who we'll talk about later, immediately after the Tour de France, Red Bull there with a pen, a piece of paper, and said, right, sign here, a few more years, X, you know, increase in salary for the foreseeable future. With Only, that has not happened at all with Pitnick. But yeah, in terms of figures, I would be very surprised if, it's highly unlikely, I'd say, that they're simply just going to add his contract from 2026 and 2027 and say, right, sign, we'll give you those two sums put together and we'll take Only off your hands. It is going to be, you know, I would say several million. I mean, if you look at, for example, Ayuso, you know, I think I reported that was roughly a 10 million euro buyout. Only's going to be not pushing 10 million, of course, but he's going to be in that conversation for a few million for sure. So, and he's definitely not earning a few million per year or even over 2 years at where he is right now.
Dan, from the rider's point of view, I suppose it makes a lot of sense. I mean, first point, and this picture will probably resurface in the next few days when the signing is reported. It's well known that he was a Team Sky fan when he was younger, and he was inspired by Team Sky to start cycling. There are pictures of him in the Team Sky jersey. So there's that. He's going to get better support at Ineos. He's presumably going to be on a bigger salary. So probably a pretty easy decision to make. From his point of view, I don't know if anyone else has been sniffing around, Dan. I mean, he said he did a short interview with some reporters at a little Australian race, sort of pre-season race the other day, and he said 15 teams had inquired about his availability. I don't know whether in the last 2 or 3 weeks other teams besides Ineos have been active in trying to sign him. But so I can see it makes sense from his point of view. From the Ineos point of view, Dan, what sort of, if there is a surprising aspect of this for me, it's that there have been a lot of questions about Ineos's commitment generally to the cycling project over the last few months and indeed couple of years. Ineos sort of pulling back a little bit from their involvement in professional sport, things like the All Blacks and sailing and so on and so forth. And there has been this sort of sense that maybe they've got one foot out of the door. Also, Ineos as a company, and this is widely, widely reported, still a massive company, enormous turnover. Jim Ratcliffe still, I don't know whether he's still considered or still reported to be the richest man in the UK, but still someone with huge resources. Nonetheless, there has been this sort of narrative that they might have a foot out of the door in professional cycling. This would seem to suggest, because it will be a big financial commitment, that it's either last throw of the dice in terms of a big British leader, bearing in mind also that the Tour de France is going to start in Scotland next year, or this is a clear statement that they are still in for the long haul. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if you'd asked me 12 months ago, what is the future of Ineos Grenadiers in cycling, I would have at one point told you that I thought they were done, as in like they could fold at the end of 2025 or 2026. You know, they'd lost Pidcock. They were all over the place. The results were terrible. The last 12 months, you've seen a bit of a stabilisation. They've always been slow with contract extensions and signings, and their transfer activity is, since maybe 2021, 2022, a lot of questionable deals there that you think, what is the purpose there? But I think bringing on Lee, bringing on a couple of other riders that they have in the last few weeks and months kind of solidifies in my mind that they are going to go ahead and go forward for, you know, the foreseeable future. How long that lasts, who knows? But I think they are definitely putting in place certain building blocks. And it's not just at the World Tour level. You know, we are, again, imminently going to find out, maybe even today, certainly in the next week or so, that they're going to have the U23 team, 10 to 12 riders, I think 12 riders on there for next season. They signed Noval, who's going to apparently come across as one of the most expensive juniors in 2027. So they are making moves in the transfer market and building something that's wouldn't approach it as calling it a legacy, but is definitely making me think they've got deeper roots than they may have had 12 months ago or a couple of years ago. So I think that their future in the sport is definitely okay. But what Onley gives them right now for the next 2 years, whether or not you think he's going to win the tour or not, or whether you think he could even get fourth again or not, is he gives them a narrative, which at the moment, if you look at their roster, they don't really have. You know, he's definitely an upgrade on Rodriguez, for example. He's definitely an upgrade on a number of other riders who I don't think quite have it in their locker to become potential top fives in the Tour de France over the next 2 years. British rider. I mean, it's very similar to what they did with Wiggins in 2009, 2010. Mm. He had that. I mean, Wiggins obviously had a much deeper pedigree on the track and was, you know, superb time trialist. But he had that breakthrough year in, what, 2009, finished third, fourth in the Tour. Ineos at the time was Sky, and they were looking at Nibali, I think, to start with. He was at Liquigas. Then they turned their attention to Wiggins straight away, straight after the Tour. And it's a very similar situation. You know, that Garmin Slipstream team, some parallels with Pitnick in terms of where roughly they are. In terms of pecking order, you'd argue that Garmin were probably better, deeper roster at the time. But there's a lot of similarities there. I think bringing in Onley gives them that narrative for at least the next couple of years. And maybe he's not the answer to beating Pogacar or competing with Remco or Vingegaard, but he's definitely a upgrade on what they've got for the next couple of seasons.
Final thing I'd say about Onley is that obviously there's the big risk that he might suffer from sort of second season syndrome. It's going to be hard to back up that Tour de France result from this year. It's going to be a lot of pressure on him, particularly if he does go to Ineos. However, he's not a one-dimensional rider. He's a fast rider. He's a punchy rider. He can be competitive in other races besides the Tour, which is not maybe the case. You know, a Carlos Rodriguez, you take him to the Tour as the leader and it goes badly, then he's seen as a failure, whereas Onley could have a great Ardennes Classic season. You know, okay, maybe not goes well in the Tour, but it's still not going to be a disaster. The second thing I would say is it just feels a bit of a shame that Pitnick, again, have spotted this rider. So they should have the sort of first mover advantage. You could say they were able to exploit that last year with him finishing fourth in the Tour, but well, their efforts to sort of develop him, spot him, develop him, they will be rewarded financially in the sense that maybe the payout will save the team or, you know, sort of bankroll the team for the next year or two. But it always does feel a little bit of a shame when the sort of big piranha comes along and just kind of gobbles up the small fish or the rider that's been developed by the small fish team, I suppose, as Pitnick would be in this case.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, Pitnick are a team that I know they don't have the budgets or the roster to compete. They're a team that have their own way of doing things, and they've always been open to, you know, releasing riders and moving them on for compensation, I would say. I mean, you look at like Dumoulin, Hirschi, Barguil, like over the years, has been Matthews, has been so many, and on the women's side too, Ninka-Vinka in the last few weeks. It is a shame in that sense, but you think about from a business point of view, it could make a lot of sense to them. If those figures are correct, you know, 5 to 7 million or there or thereabouts in million euros, that fundamentally means that they can rebuild their roster. Not for 2026, it's too late, unless they, you know, go out and get, you know, Derek G or something, which I haven't heard about, but you know, they're going to have a much shallower roster for next season. But, you know, 5 to 7 million, that definitely means you can make some moves early on at the start of next year to build towards 2027. And look, I mean, at the start of 2024, 2025, I think a lot of people would have said Max Poole and Onley were roughly the same level. Like, you could split them a little bit. And Max Poole, you know, he showed a lot of promise in the Giro, had a couple of crashes, and it didn't quite work out for him. But that could have happened only at the Tour, and it could have been the other way around. So maybe they're looking at thinking, well, okay, yeah, Onley might win the Tour in the next 3 or 4 years, but we could develop, and they've proven it time and time again, to give them their credit, that they can get riders to develop at a really good pace and bring them through quite quickly. Their problem has always been retaining that talent because they don't have the financial resources that the bigger teams have. But they do find a way. And even if you look at their roster this year at the Tour, like, I'd say a lot of their riders outperformed where you thought they would be in terms of the support they gave Onley. And I think that's a good thing for the future too. Like, they might not have the star names on their roster at the moment or even for next year. And losing Onley is definitely a blow. Like, I mean, there's no way around it. But yeah, if they carry on, developing riders at the same rate they do, they will have another rider in the next 2-3 years that can potentially equal or even outclips what Onley did this year.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the best and fastest virtual private network in the world, designed primarily to protect your online security and all of your important data wherever you're online. But there are a host of other benefits too. And as you listen to the cycling podcast, you can get the very best discount off a NordVPN plan by using our special link, which is nordvpn.com/TCP. That link will also be in the episode show notes. And if you use that link, it will give you an additional 4 months extra for free when you take out a 2-year plan with NordVPN. It's no risk as well, because Nord has a 30-day money-back guarantee. Now, a NordVPN subscription can be used on up to 10 devices, so you can protect everything in your household, whether it's your laptop or phone, tablet, even your smart TV, or as we do at home, we can sign up the internet router so that anything connected to your internet connection will be protected by NordVPN. And the most important thing is to protect all of those important details and data, such as your bank details, passwords, and your online identity. NordVPN threat protection also protects you from viruses, malicious malware, and phishing websites. But the other benefits are significant too. You can switch your virtual location, which can save you money when you're buying things like flights, hotel rooms, and subscriptions, because companies charge different rates depending on where the customers are. Sometimes, hard to believe, I know, but you can use NordVPN to get the best possible price. And when you're traveling abroad, you can carry on watching your favorite streaming services or sports events as if you were at home. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP and sign up today.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Well, Dan, a lot more we could say about Oscar Onley, Ineos, as you have already hinted. It could all be done and dusted today. And one other thing that did occur to me was that it's late in the day to be planning a season, and bearing in mind that he might have to, well, he might be riding a new bike, a different bike in a week's time, and obviously a whole new set of staff to get to know, a lot of things that will have to go into planning his 2026 if he does go to Ineos. It is late, but it's not without precedent, of course. I had a look back, Dan, at the news around this time of year last year, and Tom Pidd got moved to Q36.5 on the 6th of December. We're the 12th of December currently, so not a whole lot of time to sort of get going, as I say, get fitted up for a new bike, new equipment, everything, plan the season. In a minute, we're going to talk about Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. They've already sort of sketched out their whole, their race programs for all of their Grand Tour leaders. You've got teams like Uno X are already altitude before Christmas, so they will be a bit time squeezed for next year, but I don't think that is going to be a deal breaker or something that will make them panic too much. Dan, said we are going to focus mainly on Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. They have been in Mallorca, as is usually the case with that team. Obviously, a German team, the Germans, La Mallorca. Dan, there was a time in the 1980s where a German tabloid newspaper suggested that the German government buy Mallorca. It's considered such an integral part of the sort of German national collective kind of psyche, Mallorca. However, they didn't buy Mallorca, but Red Bull, the German team par excellence, they continue to go there. Dan, they've been there this week, media day. I usually attend this. I didn't attend this week, but Dan, the media day itself seems to become a bigger and bigger event every year. There's quite a lot of sort of fanfare around it. There was this sort of publicity stunt with the plane this year.
Yeah.
What was that all about?
A glider or something. They took off, they had a bunch of riders do a lead out and lift off a glider. I mean, I know nothing about physics or science, but it seemed impressive to me.
You know a lot about transfers, yeah, but not much about gliders.
No. Yeah, they did have the glider at the media day, which was nice to see. But lots of publicity stunts, new kits, riders in new kits, and other than Remco, obviously. And it was a pretty good event, to be fair, like well run. Good media team they've got there at that Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. And all the riders were there to do one-on-ones or round tables at the very least, and the staff too, including Zach Dempster and Ralph Denk. The vibe was pretty good, to be fair. I didn't feel any sense of tension. This is
one of the slightly frustrating things about these events and training camps across all the teams at this time of year. Everything always feels good, Dan. The vibes are always good. Everyone's always optimistic. Everyone's always happy. There's not that much. Often you feel there's a distinct lack of real talk and realism. Indeed, it's all about, it's generally about what's going to, it's a fairly hopeful vision of what is going to happen in the future. Nothing wrong with that, of course. And I think I remarked in a podcast this time last year that it's actually quite pleasant. Everyone is upbeat this time of the year, talking about next year. But it's a lot of sort of good intentions, resolutions, and so on. But Dan, it's going to be a huge year for Red Bull, because last year wasn't that successful. I mean, as I've already kind of touched on, we wind the clock back a year, there was a lot of talk about changes, how things were going to be better in 2025. What did happen with Red Bull in 2025? Well, 23 wins, 10 of them were in the World Tour. They finished the season sixth in the UCI rankings, behind Astana and Sudal. They'd been fifth in 2024. So Dan, by all, I would say, by pretty much anyone's estimation, it was a fairly disappointing year with some highlights. Lipovic's third place in the Tour de France was a huge highlight. And of course, they've been the big movers of the transfer window, I suppose. They've landed the biggest coup in signing Remco Evenepoel. Another big coup, Dan, was or has been one contract extension in particular. And there'd been some speculation in the last few weeks about Florian Lipovic maybe leaving, going to another, what is also a German team, Little Trek. I didn't really believe that at the time. I didn't really think there was much substance to that at the time, Dan. Knowing Red Bull and knowing how important it is as a German team to have the biggest German rider, I was fairly confident that they would have done everything to tie him down. And Dan, Ralph Denk, the other day, 2 days ago, he announced that that is indeed what they have done. They have tied Lipovic down, and he wasn't the only contract extension that was announced.
Yeah, Lorenzo Finn, he's got a World Tour contract, so he'll join the World Tour in 2027. So he was the other big announcement that they made on the stage, including Lipovic. I mean, just going back to your previous point, I mean, yeah, they didn't have a great year in 2025. In many ways, they regressed. I think the biggest issue for them was around the classics. Like, you look at what they brought in, you know, Jan Tratnik, the Van Dijk brothers, Van Giels, Pithy, Moscon, and of course, Lazcano, who we know is no longer on the team. But if you look at all those riders, I mean, Tratnik had a lot of bad luck, but none of them really performed well. They were off the pace so badly in the classics from right the way through from February up until, you know, April, really. Maybe a bit better in the Ardennes, but that for me was, you know, a real indication of the fact that they changed a lot and didn't necessarily make the right changes. I mean, I've written about this before, but they let a rider like Marco Haller go, and you think, okay, what? Marco Haller doesn't win a lot of races, but he was a fundamental part of that Classics and even Grand Tour team. He made the Grand Tour team, the Tour de France team in 2024, and they let him go, didn't want to extend his contract. And I feel like they changed too much too soon and made too many small changes, and it just didn't come together. And when you're in the Classics, for example, it's so hard once you've lost that momentum in the first couple of races to get it back by the end of March and into April. And they were just on the back foot and they were woeful from there. And that kind of set the tone. And even in their Tour de France, you know, they were kind of disjointed at times, questionable tactics, wasn't really sure who the leader was. I wasn't really sure who the leader was even going into the final weekend, given how they were racing together. So, a few highlights in there. Lipovic's white jersey, third, great result. But lots of question marks, and you can kind of see that, or you kind of wonder, you know, are they repeating that pattern again by making wholesale fundamental changes?
Well, yeah, this is, I mean, I've got a list of sort of bullet points I was going to ask you about, Dan, and this was down the list, but we might as well discuss it now. And this is probably the fundamental, the key point and the key question is, can they thrive in another year of what looks from the outside like a complete overhaul? And it's the third consecutive year when there's been some kind of overhaul or some kind of revolution. And, you know, I've got a very clear sense of this by attending the Media Day training camp the last 2 years. So at the end of 2023, it was Roglic arriving, and we were sort of told that that signaled a new dawn for the team and a new direction for the team, a new sort of a new push to join the sort of super teams. This followed Red Bull coming on board, Red Bull were fully absorbed and became part of the ownership of the team the following spring, but we already were hearing about it at the end of 23. So that was 1 year of a huge change. Then last year there was another series of change, particularly sort of behind the scenes, kind of in the sports science, in the nutrition department, that was completely overhauled. Dan Bigham and Johnny Whale came on board on sort of the aerodynamic side. And all I heard, Dan, at the start of last year, before the Classics, during the Classics, after the Classics, was there had been an awful lot that had changed. And it was just it was a big effort. And these teams, Dan, and maybe you'll be able to speak to this as well, just sort of being around the camps this week, these teams are huge bloated organizations now, and Red Bull, with the resources that they have, they sort of epitomize this maybe as much as any team in the World Tour, that these are sprawling organizations. And you talk to people who work for teams nowadays, and they talk about the number of meetings they have to do and the number of Zoom calls there are every week, and it's just difficult to make all the parts fit, particularly when you're talking about riders and sort of teams within teams who won't sort of see each other again for the rest of the year. And this year again, Remco coming on board and a complete sort of overhaul of the direct sportifs as well. I don't know how many have left. Dan Hausler's left, Eisel's left, Gasparotto's left, Aldag, the sort of team manager, has left as well. And that's just a few of them. There are more, I think. So it's another year when the team is going to be almost, in some respects, unrecognisable. Is this another recipe for difficulty and struggle?
It's such a difficult question to answer, because if you look at the last couple of years, you'd say, yeah, they're just kind of repeating the same mistakes. But I do believe that at some point they will click and they will get it right. So I think they've probably identified things that needed to improve from the very start of 2025, and they've put those in place. I do have more confidence in Zach Dempster than perhaps I had in elements of the previous regime to get things moving in the right direction. I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, how you're going to define what success means for that team in 2026. Like, is it being top three in the world tour rankings, which I think is definitely attainable? Is it just solely on Remco and whether or not that signing pulls off? Or is it a case of all the other riders just developing and growing, and Pellizzari having a good Giro, for example, and Lipovic going back to the tour and having great success? So yeah, I think they've got all the weapons at their disposal that they need to be the second or third best team in the world, looking at points and success and wins. Whether or not that translates on the road, I'm not sure. I do think they'll go through another big overhaul in 2026 to 2027 because a lot of the riders they brought in on a two-year deal at the start of 2025 will be out of contract. So I think we will see another roster overhaul. I do think that the management, you know, that they brought in, you know, like Bingham, for example, he's going into what, his second, third year now at Dempster. I think they'll get a little bit more leeway and rope. I think Denk realises probably that he can't just overhaul it every single season. So I think they'll probably get a good two-year window in which to develop and get the time they need. And also it's probably another year where they'll have an opportunity to look at their rookies programme and their U23 programme and bring riders through that system. And I remember speaking to Dempster in October or November, just after he'd, or a couple of months in after he'd joined. And he also talked about like riders that on the roster that have really underperformed since they've either joined or come through the ranks. And, you know, identifying them and saying, you know, we need to also go back to those riders and get more out of them. It's not just a case of we'll plug this hole or we'll fix this team by signing the best rider available on the market. And I think there's a lot of truth to that too. I think the question I had for Dempster at the when I had a one-on-one with him at the media day was like, is your role more about, you know, cycling and getting success or about the diplomacy of managing expectations and goals? And that's not, in the Remco case, that's not just about Remco, that's about his whole entourage that's come across. You know, it's not just one rider that's come across. It's a couple of, you know, a DS, a couple of riders, you know, one from 2025, another for 2026. I'm sure that he's got other support staff there, a mechanical sommelier or whatever. So and obviously they don't have a say in what the race program is, but it all kind of adds up. And Bell, the national coach, obviously, that's come through too. So I think Dempster's got a lot on his plate to handle for the next, you know, next 12 months. But you look at that roster. I mean, it is stacked. They are going to all three Grand Tours with the objective of winning, or at the very least, getting on the podium with one rider. And you look at the roster, and other than UAE, I don't think there's another team out there that can do that. So, yeah, they've got all the tools, they've got all the weapons. It's just about whether or not they can kind of deliver on that expectancy.
Yeah, I do agree with you about Dempster. I mean, he's someone who's been at Ineos Grenadiers for a couple of years now, and he's a very good communicator, a charming guy, actually, someone who I think the majority of riders will take to. And how much contact individual riders have with the sort of overarching team manager, I mean, that's a sort of moot point again, which speaks to how big these organisations are now. But I do have some confidence in him.
Just on Dempster, like, I think he made the right impression with the riders, and that does come across. I mean, I know you say everyone looks, you know, happy and buoyant and so on and so forth, but there are always undertones at training camps, you know, about stress, about any kind of polarisation within the camp or cliques. I genuinely did not get the sense of that. I mean, obviously, let's see what the pressure's like and how that translates when it comes to real objectives. And it's telling, maybe to a degree, that they're keeping Remco Evenepoel and Primoz Roglic apart for the majority, or if not all of the entire race.
Well, completely. I mean, Dan, if Remco's got any questions about ski jumping, then he needs to ask Primoz in the next few days, because he's not going to see him again until...
Till training camp,
next year.
Well, not even then because Primoz is out of contract at the end of the season. But with Dempster, I think he made all the right impressions and moves. You know, he went to literally go and see all of these riders in person. Maybe not Remco, actually, that might have been a call. But he went to go and see Pellizzari. He went to Monaco to see Roglic, and he sat down with him for a good half day, a day, and went through objectives. And if you look at the actual how they've divided the calendar and how they divided the season, I actually think Remco's got, I wouldn't say the rawest deal, but I think he's got the hardest schedule.
Well, let's dig into that, because the race program, I mean, this is significant, obviously, because this was one of the big questions, how they were going to mesh them all. You said in your Substack post the other day, when you talked about this, there was a you said everybody seemed content, in inverted commas. Why? Because Hindley's going to the Giro. That was what he wanted to do, apparently. Pellizzari also expressed his desire to go to the Giro. He's been, well, that wish has been granted. Vlasov is also going to the Giro. Then they've got Lipovitz and Evenepoel for the Tour de France. And Roglic already knows that he is doing the Vuelta. I think you made the point in your post as well, that this sort of, as well as what the riders themselves wanted, it looks as though it makes sense. We know that Roglic, well, we know about his affinity with the Vuelta. We know he's going for the record on his own as the winner of his fifth Vuelta. Yeah. Isn't it? It'll be his fifth Vuelta. Yeah. So it kind of makes sense from that point of view as well, wouldn't you agree?
100%. I think they've been really respectful to Roglic in terms of, you know, giving him. I mean, he's the only one on that list, actually, who's at the moment, and obviously things change. You don't know who crashes at the Tour, who gets sick or whatever, and maybe gets shunted to the Vuelta. But right now, he's the only one on that team, GC candidate, true GC candidate, that's got a Grand Tour where he is the sole leader. So you can say it's the Vuelta, it's not the Tour, it's not the Giro. But also, if you're Roglic, you're thinking, oh, you know, perhaps, you know, okay, I'm not going to win the Tour. I've come to that realisation that it's too much. It's beyond me. I had that chance. It's kind of slipped through. But my legacy, going to the Vuelta, getting that fifth title, that's a nice way to potentially retire, which I don't think you'll do, but potentially leave the team or move on to another level. But I think that suits him really well. I think sending him to the Tour would be not a disservice in a way, but I don't think he wants to go, and I don't think they want it. The team management, I don't think they want to send him to the Tour de France as a super domestique. I think we've seen that that does not quite work out. It's a little bit of a distraction, and it's not the role that he is willing or capable of doing.
I mean, we've also talked in the past about the fact that Remco Evenepoel, his positioning is not maybe his strongest suit, particularly going into sort of short, punchy climbs. And Roglic, last year, there was a huge amount of effort and attention dedicated at Red Bull to how they were going to position him before climbs, and a huge amount of manpower that required as well. And one of the areas in which Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe maybe slightly... slightly exposed is the volume, the number of mountain domestiques or domestiques for these guys. And so you certainly can't take Lipovic, Evenepoel and Roglic to the Tour de France and give them the help they will need, particularly in that kind of scenario. Dan, you said that Remco had maybe got the rawest deal. Just to outline what we know about his program, so we think he's going to do the Mallorca Challenge. Don't know how many of those races he'll do. Obviously, that's a sort of pick and mix. You can do as many as you
want.
One,
like. I think.
So that's just at the one. End. Is I he only doing one?
He'll do the TTT for sure with Lipovic, and then maybe he does another one just to stretch his legs. But at the moment, I think it's just that.
Okay. So that's the end of January, start of February. Then Volta Valenciana. That starts on the 4th of February. Then Catalunya, which is the 23rd of March. So I guess, Dan, they talked about a big altitude block with Lipovic, didn't they? Will that be between Valenciana and Catalunya, maybe at the end of February, start of March? Then the Ardennes Classics, Amstel Flesh, Liège. Then I guess another stint at altitude. And then in June, I looked at his programme and I saw a race called the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes, and I didn't know what the hell they were referring to. And of course, that is the race formerly known as the Dauphiné. We're going to have to get used to that. And then, of course, the Tour de France with Lipovic. I think, Dan, that was the... We got everything. We got all of the races on Remco's program. We didn't necessarily get that for Hindley and some of the other riders. Roglic, I think he's doing Tirreno, Basque Country, Romandie, and that's as far as it goes. Of course, we know is another race that he wants to win before he retires is Tour of Switzerland. The route for the Tour of Switzerland, and this is another problem for all the teams, but the route for the Tour of Switzerland is not going to be announced until March. So that makes planning a little bit difficult. And also, you know, just thinking, Dan, about how teams conduct these media days and camps and what they reveal about riders' programs, is often they don't know what the routes are going to be. And, well, we still don't know what the Vuelta route's going to be. We've heard speculation that it's going to be one of the hardest routes of the last 20 years or whatever. And they also don't know who else is going to compete. Red Bull go ahead regardless, and I think they've probably got enough information for emotional reasons as well to know, you know, what are the best options. But there are some teams, I mean, we were talking about Only and Picnic, they've always had this policy that it's kind of ridiculous to announce their teams more than a sort of month in advance, because of fitness, because they don't know which other riders are going to be competing, because of they don't know the route in some cases. But Red Bull have decided, as they've done for the last few years, to be very transparent about this.
Yeah, and I think that's the right approach. I mean, there's still a lot of gaps in calendars. It was quite interesting the fact that the media day took place before a number of riders, even some of the GC riders, had their full schedules. So, you know, Roglic knew like three or four of his races, but didn't know much else. And even with Remco, I still think there's an option or some options to update and change that schedule, even if he has the perfect run and there's no injuries and there's no issues. I know they looked at UAE a little bit. I still think there's a possibility later down the line that he might get dropped into Flanders. I know he said he wouldn't do it, but let's see how that goes.
Remco.
I think I just get the sense that it's a possibility. Like, I know he's fundamentally saying, you know, it's not on my calendar for 2026, but closer to the time, let's see what happens there. Could be completely wrong. Might just completely bypass it for another season. But I wouldn't completely rule it out, or rather, I wouldn't be surprised if there was a modification. And when it comes to June, I know we see the Dauphiné in there, for example, but I still think they're looking at, you know, what the routes will be for Slovenia, again, Swiss, and the Dauphiné, and then deciding from there as to where they kind of split their leaders. I think the only race that Evenepoel does with Lipovic before the Tour is Catalunya. And again, like we said, we don't know what Pellizzari's complete program will be, I don't think, and we don't know what Hindley's complete program will be yet either. But yeah, I think they've given all their GC riders good objectives to aim for. And when I said, you know, Evenepoel's got the, I think I said he doesn't have the, I wouldn't say it was the rawest deal, but I think he's got the most he's got the most challenging schedule. You know, he's not shying away from anything, which is good. You know, he's going to go to the Tour de France. He's going to aim for the highest possible GC position there. But he also doesn't have sole leadership. And you can take that as a positive and you can take that as a negative, depending on where he finishes in Paris. But he also has, you know, he doesn't have that kind of, I guess, free hand or, I guess, relaxed position that maybe Roglic does. And he's obviously not going to the Giro where, you know, probably has a better, well, I think he's got a better chance of winning the Giro in 2026 than the Tour. So he's going to be judged with much higher expectations, which of course you would expect given that he is the big signing that they made over the summer.
Yeah. One of your other posts, or you've done a bit of a series on Substack in the last couple of weeks, have been the top 100 transfers of the off season. I'd be very aggrieved if I'd changed teams and I wasn't in your top 100. I'd be extremely aggrieved because that sounds like a lot, 100. But you have rated Remco Evenepoel as the number one transfer of the closed season, which I think is fair enough. I think it's the biggest move. Maybe would there be more money involved in the Ayuso move? Probably
I think,
not.
Oh, no,
probably,
I think there would be there would. For the buyout clause. I think so. Yeah, I mean, Remco had one more year and he wasn't earning what I've heard. Okay. So I think Ayuso was probably the most cash involved.
Well, number one in terms of impact on your list anyway, Dan, but I suppose that begs the question, I mean, what will make this a success for this year? At least, I mean, part of me, Dan, thinks he's such a points machine, and I know that Red Bull, Bora Hansgrohe, they're not one of the teams that are necessarily obsessing over points and rankings, but it is becoming more and more important. We're talking about it more and more, and that ranking position sixth, they'll definitely want to improve that, and I think they see themselves as a top three team ultimately, or they need to be a top three team. So he's going to get a lot of points, whatever happens in the Tour and so on. But what do you think would be a big success? I mean, I also, just thinking about the Tour de France, as we've already touched on, I think pairing him with Lipovic is ideal because Lipovic is a sort of, he's an unassuming character, and we've seen that when he's ridden with Roglic at the Vuelta a couple of years ago, at the Tour last year. I think he's probably going to be quite an easy guy to mesh with. But Remco's natural setting is that of the alpha. And, you know, if you've seen any sort of videos, documentaries, behind-the-scenes documentaries about his time at Sudal Quickstep, he runs the show. And he's a great communicator. And in the briefings and even sort of outside the team bus talking to journalists, he sets the agenda of the team. And he needs to find, or they need to find, the yin to his yang. Probably that is Lipovic, but I don't think it's going to be easy, particularly if you get a situation where Lipovic turns out to be the stronger guy. I don't think that is going to be an easy situation to negotiate.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a successful season if Lipovic outperforms him in the Tour de France, which I don't think is an impossible situation given where Lipovic was this year in his Tour de France debut. And the fact that, you know, Remco is the big star, but he is also going to draw 90% of that attention. Of course, he likes that being centre stage, but that does come with pressure. And, you know, one thing that's also important to note, and I think going back to what would be success for Remco this season, or 2026, sorry, he hasn't won a stage race since the start of 2024. That's a long time for a guy who has won a Grand Tour and wants to continue winning Grand Tours. And that was Algarve back in February last year. Of course, he's been, you know, second in a number of races. I think Paris-Nice, he's done top tens. He's obviously finished third in the Tour in 2024 as well. But for me, success for him is getting back to consistently winning stage races, of course, one-day races too. And ultimately, he needs to demonstrate that he's closing that gap to the yellow jersey at the Tour de France. He can't go there and finish fourth or fifth. That would be a huge disappointment. He's got to go there, and in my eyes, second would be a successful result for him. You know, leapfrogging, you know, Vingegaard, for example, getting a little bit closer to Pogacar. For me, that would be deemed a success. Because, you know, ultimately, he's going to go and win virtually every time he starts. So he'll go into the season as the time trial world champion. And if he goes to Canada at the end of the year, he'll finish the season as the time trial world champion. And he'll win every race against the clock that he goes into this year as well. But for me, ultimately, he's got to show progress when it comes to the Grand Tours. And that's not just, you know, getting top fives, top tens. That's getting even closer to the yellow jersey than he was in 2024, sorry.
Dan, last thing on Red Bull before we pause and switch our attention to something else. the classics, we've alluded to them, but this time last year, it felt as though they almost had a sort of, I wouldn't say an equal kind of billing as the Grand Tours, but a big investment had been made, you know, on the classic side with the Van Dijk brothers and Lazcano. And it did go really, really badly. And then obviously we've had the Lazcano biological passport case as well. So he's out of the picture. But there weren't any major investments on the classic side. Vermeersch has come in, Gianni Vermeersch. But otherwise, it almost seems as though the team has reconciled themselves, or Denk has reconciled himself to the idea that this is primarily now a Grand Tour team. And okay, they'll go for results in the classics. They'll hope to keep things ticking over, but that's not really where the focus is. And I mean, just thinking about another signing last year was Maxime Van Hiels, and that was a sort of controversial, kind of contentious bit of a struggle to get him out of his contract with Lotto. They finally did it at the end of last year. He didn't have a great season. He had injuries and struggled a little bit. There were sort of flashes from him, but his program for next year, he's doing Jaén, Ruta del Sol, Strade Bianche, Tirreno Adriatico, Milano-Sanremo, Indurain, Basque Country, then the Ardennes. That's his program. So for the Cobble Classics, it looks like the Van Dijks and Pithy and Tratnik are still the guys.
Yeah, and it's a strong collective. They just don't have a leader. I mean, I even at the start of 2025, I would have looked at that list and gone, okay, you've got maybe numbers for certain scenarios, But when it comes to Flanders and Roubaix, I'm not quite sure who the top dog is. You know, I mean, I think they signed riders based off promise, and I think the Van Dijk brothers made them more robust. But unless you're Pogacar, or unless you're Van der Poel or Philipsen, like, winning a classic is a monument, is just so out of your reach at this point, especially on the cobbles. But yeah, Denker's probably looked at that and thought, right, well, you know, maybe Remco is that rider for Flanders in the future, and in the next few years, maybe we could develop from within our team. We've got some good one-day riders coming through in the rookies, in the U23 program. But you also have to look at the fact that there weren't that many classics riders that were on the market for 2026. You know, yeah, Stefan Kung, a couple of others, Olav Koy, if you want to look at some of the specific races. But there weren't that many classic stars on the market. And Remco ticks so many boxes that you probably think, well, if he wanted to go and target the classics at some stage in his career, you know, really go all in on the cobbles, then he could do that. And like I said earlier, I think they will give those classics riders one more crack. In some cases, I think maybe two more cracks, because some of them are three-year contracts. And then we might see another refresh. Johnny Vermeersch, very experienced rider. He'll give them a bit more versatility and a bit more experience there. But yeah, I think they'll also look at, and again, going back to the earlier point, I do think they'll look at some of the riders that they've got on that roster that maybe haven't got the results that they would have expected over the last couple of years, and expect more of them, or look to get more out of them. Van Poppel, in certain races, he's going to take on more sprint responsibilities, and that ties in with some of the classics, not all of them. They brought in a rider to help out with his lead out. They obviously, you know, they let Sam Welswood go, but they also made a purposeful point of not going after a massive sprinter on the market. I think they did look a little bit coy early on, but ultimately, they had to build a whole lead out around him as well. It would detract from the main objectives around, like you said, the Grand Tours, and with Remco kind of being on their radar to such a high level at that point in the season, they didn't go in for what I would call like a second tier sprinter either. You know, they were very, very calculated on their approach for next season. So yeah, definitely a Grand Tour team, but like I said, I mean, with Remco, he can turn his hand to pretty much anything he wants in the next 3 or 4 years. So bringing him on board gives you that flexibility, so that, you know, even if he doesn't do Flanders and San Remo in 2026, it's definitely an option for 2027.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time, and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget, so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
You're listening to Kilometer Zero by the Cycling Podcast.
Everything I could to come back and here and standing in Tour de France and win a stage is amazing.
And I also said that just sitting in the beach in Mallorca and drinking champagne or wine from lunch and rest of the day, that's not the perfect life.
Sensationally, a ride a few outside Norway had heard of before that day, Zacharias Koller-Luland, claimed the jackpot in Bassano del Grappa.
1X l'anno scorso con Magnus Kort.
And the way it happened with the rider and that story, it couldn't be better. But
that was a little extract from our latest Kilometer Zero episode on, well, it's the latest in our series about the teams that either avoided relegation from the World Tour last year, or in the case of Cofidis, were ultimately relegated from the World Tour. As I said earlier, UCI announced the definitive list earlier this week of the 18 teams that will be in the World Tour next year, Uno X making the cut. The last episode of that series for Friends of the Cycling Podcast, you can become a friend by clicking on the link on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. And the last installment is going to be about Cofidis. That's probably the juiciest installment. A lot of information, eyewitness accounts there of what exactly has been going wrong at Cofidis over the last 3 years, and that last episode will be coming in the next few days. Talking of friend specials, Kilometer Zeros, a couple of weeks ago I referred back to one we released earlier in the year, just before the Giro d'Italia, about Albania. Of course, Giro started in Albania this year, and it was Land of Eagles, and that was the kind of curious story of an Englishman who had ended up settling in Albania, Bene, who became a bit of a mythical figure, legendary sort of figure, on the back of the wild story he told in this episode, this Kilometer Zero episode, Land of Eagles. I did also say I would give you an update, or I'd give those who enjoyed that episode an update on what Bene has been doing over the last 6 months. Well, as I think we found out, the Giro, he didn't actually attend the start of the Giro. He was bike packing around Greece, North Macedonia, and then heading back to Albania. He ended up spending, I think, the late summer honey harvesting at an eco farm in southern Albania, and recently he's been back in the UK. But when I told him that, when the Giro was presented a couple of weeks ago and we were talking about the Grande Partenza in Bulgaria, when I told him that I'd spoken to our mutual friend Nini, the Albanian national coach, and Nini had been sort of bemoaning the lack of legacy, lack of positive impact of the Giro d'Italia on Albanian cycling, Bene wrote me this. I'm afraid, in my opinion, something like cycling infrastructure is way down on Albania's list of priorities. Rama, that's the Albanian prime minister, is a bit of an enigma because theoretically his socialist party opposes the more conservative Democrats, but then he's all about show and pomps, his relationship with Giorgia Meloni in Italy. It's hard not to think that bringing the Giro was largely a stunt for him, as for regular Albanians. Outside the younger people in Tirana, few have a sense of leisure activity for the sake of leisure. They can't understand why I hike, because I like hiking. The car is so dominant, not just logistically, lack of public transport alternatives other than minibuses, but also in terms of status. You just look weak and poor if you travel by bike, sadly. But it is not all about money. For example, I see how in awe many African countries are of their athletes running or cycling on their roads. There doesn't seem to be the same mindset in Albania. You're just in the way. So, unfortunately, that from Bene, kind of confirming what we heard from Nini a couple of weeks ago about, unfortunately, the state of cycling in Albania. Dan, you are not in Albania. You are in Spain. You've got Little Trek this afternoon, we said, didn't you? What's the big question? What is the big burning question for Little Trek?
Little Trek. Oh, it's got to be around Ayuso and how he's going to settle in and that whole environment. I mean, they made it really clear in the build-up to his, you know, arrival that, you know, they are a collective. They all pile in and work together. And you can see that with how they've split things with Milan and Pedersen this year, for example. But the arrival of Ayuso ruffled a few feathers with a couple of riders when that was announced and how that was announced. But just his arrival on that team potentially brings them to the next level. But obviously, with the way in which it ended at UAE, it does leave you with questions over how that relationship and dynamic is going to work between him, the rest of his teammates and the management, which I think is fair. But I mean, like I think I said on the Substack, like whatever happens, it's definitely not going to be dull. So
Dan, do we know anything about his program yet? Or we'll probably find out this afternoon.
No, I think we'll find out this afternoon. I mean, I would guess he's doing the tour and then just building back from that. And then with Skelmos, I would presume he goes to a different grand tour as the leader, maybe doubles up at the tour as another option, but I would assume they split things out across both riders when it comes to GC.
Do we know whether Ayuso has brought any kind of entourage with him? I mean, we just talked about Remco. We know that he has, and he was sort of granted that. But Ayuso's that move was a lot more sort of hastily put together, and I don't know whether there was any provision made for coaches. I don't think there's any DS that's come with him.
No DSs that I know of. I mean, I've got a feeling, and this is just like just trying to dredge through my memory, he might have brought Swanya, but that's it, I believe. I think I'll double check that today, but yeah, there were no riders obviously that came with him, and no major staff changes at the both teams. So
one thing with that strikes me with Ayuso, and thinking about the eventuality of him riding the Tour, I think there's a feeling that Mads Pedersen will probably be sent back to the Tour this year, and that Milan will maybe go to the Giro, which was the sort of the reverse of what happened this year. But I always think, and I've said this many times, I always think that team rides much better when Pedersen is in the team as a whole. They all ride much better, and that's partly because he, because of his charisma and his authority, he gives clarity and he kind of sets the boundaries for the team. And if you think of Ayuso's reputation that he'll be trying to shed this year, of being a little bit sort of wayward and a little bit headstrong, I think if he has sort of a firm hand, a firm influence alongside him, which sort of communicates to him that he has to really toe the party line, I think that's probably going to be a good thing for him, personally.
Yeah, I definitely see a scenario in which those two are, you know, complete pillars of that team and potentially have a really good relationship together. I think Pedersen won't stand for any bullshit. And that's not an Ayuso thing. I think that's across the board. Like, I think if he sees something that he doesn't like, whether it's staff or riders, in the right way, but obviously in a quite a blunt and upfront way, he will call it out and he will make that very, very clear of what the expectations are, what is okay and what is not okay, whether it's on the bus, whether it's on the road, whether it's at the dinner table. I think he sets, like you said, I think he sets the tone for that team. So I think that definitely gives Ayuso a potential ally in that sense, or someone to look to as guidance. And I don't think he got that at UAE from the start.
It's not that kind of team.
From the riders. No, it's not. And it's very much like you are either Team Pogacar or you are basically out effectively, really, or you know, you're not going to move up that pecking order, basically. Maybe not out, but definitely not moving up that pecking order. So, it's very much on Ayuso, though, to prove any doubters that he has that, you know, he's got it, both as a rider too, but also just fundamentally that he can work as a teammate when required. And I think the early few months for that will be really important. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how many races he does with Pedersen, like any of those early stage races, whether or not they go to Paris-Nice together or, I don't know, Provence or something like that, and just work together as a unit and kind of hit the ground running in that sense. Because I think that would be... that'd be a good thing for both riders.
Yeah, I think it's a good team for him in that respect, because there are, again, going back to something I said earlier about how unwieldy some of these organisations are now, and it's difficult to impose a sense of sort of identity and sort of soul and or a style of riding or a style of behaving upon the whole organisation, because generally they're sort of one team that made up of sort of five or six different teams, and often the individuals don't see each other throughout the year. But Little Trek is a team, I would say, with a sort of through line of kind of values and a way of behaving, and some of that does come from individuals like Mads Pedersen, but I think that's kind of the almost the opposite to Little Trek, to UAE, which feels a lot more kind of disparate, in spite of obviously Pogacar being the centre of gravity.
Yeah, I mean, the onus is definitely on Ayuso to buy in. Yeah. Like, it's not the other way around. I mean, he's not coming there as a four or five-time Grand Tour winner. He's coming there primarily because he didn't work out for him at UAE for a variety of different reasons. So the onus is definitely on him to make it work. And he comes in there with question marks, which are some warranted, some maybe not. And it's not the other way around. You know, Little Trek are not this team that have this, I guess, element of previous difficulty, you know, like, for example, I used to have with certain elements of the UAE management. So it very much is on him to make this work. And I think, again, it starts today. I know it's just a training camp, but it really just starts with how you know, the objectives are laid out for both him and Skelmos and Pedersen and a few other riders, Milan and so on and so forth, and how that's communicated. I think that is important. And then, yeah, we'll see in the first few races as to how that kind of transpires. Because the microscope will definitely be on him, right? Every time he's at the back of the peloton where he might or could be at the front, every time a teammate needs assistance, people will be looking at him. You know what it's going to be like on TV comms, on social media. He draws that attention because of the last couple of years and what's happened and the team around him at UAE. So the microscope would definitely be on how he behaves, perhaps more so than how he performs in terms of the first 3 or 4 months,
yeah,
for sure.
I think if I was his team manager, if I was Luca Guadagnino, and I'd tell him his objective is to get through 2026 with no memes having been made about him. Dan, as I said earlier on in the top of today's episode, I sort of used this maybe unflattering epithet about the British royal family, but it was intended as a compliment to say that in a very short space of time, I mean, you've been working in this industry for a long time, but in a short space of time, relatively short space of time, you've established your Substack as a real, the most authoritative source, certainly on transfers, but more besides that. And I just thought we'd finish today by talking a little bit about that. I can see that you've done it through hard work, relentlessly hard work, but it was an interesting route that you chose because you were the editor of Cycling News for a long time. And then when you left Cycling News 2 or 3 years ago, you found yourself with a choice to make, and you chose Substack as your vehicle, and it seems to be, it's working very well from the point of view of your readers because they're getting a lot.
Oh, thank you. I was at CN for like 14 years. I think 14 years, roughly. I left there in 2020, end of 2021. Then I did 10 months at Velo News, and that didn't quite work out. Although I think I did an all right job. And then luckily I got snapped up by GCN, and that did go well until they closed the website, which was a bit unfortunate. And then I was like a bit of a crossroads because I didn't really know what to do. I didn't really want to go into the same sort of position again, but I know I wanted to stay within cycling. Substack.
Why did you want to stay in cycling? I get asked this a lot. Having been in cycling for 25 years.
What else is there? No, I still felt like I could do a good job in terms of my expertise and knowledge. And I looked at a couple of little things. And I did at one point have an offer to go back and do, not at the same level, but work within a title, I guess a media organisation, and do similar things to what I was doing at previous titles, not at the same. I wasn't going to be editor or anything like that, but by then I'd already set up Substack, and that just felt like the right move at the right time, to some degree. I mean, I was very nervous about it because I didn't want to launch a project and then 3 weeks later just realize it was just a disaster. But I got some, you know, good help, good advice, and good support early on in those days, just setting it up. People around me, and that made a big difference, and I was very grateful in those first few days and first few weeks because it could have gone either way, really, like a title. And I didn't even really know much about Substack other than one women's cycling newsletter that I was subscribing to, and it's been a lot of fun the last 18 months or so. Really enjoyed it. I like working for myself. It comes with a lot of pressure and a lot of sometimes stress to a degree, but also it is really rewarding in the sense that, you know, building a community, the subscribers I'm very, very grateful for that I have, the free subscribers, anyone that's going to supports me, you know, on a monthly or yearly basis too, like it is, and you know too from the podcast too, like having an audience like that is feel responsible for it, and it's really fantastic, and it's definitely like the happiest I've been and most fulfilled I've been in terms of working in cycling for a long time in that sense. I miss certain aspects of like working with other people on a day-to-day basis and being part of a team in that sense, but I've really enjoyed it.
is this the shape of things to come for the whole industry? Because, I mean, it's something that we're confronted with on a sort of year-by-year basis. You know, we've seen massive changes in the landscape, in the media landscape in cycling, and it's at times it's very difficult to know how it's going to develop over the next 5 or 10 years. As you say, there are sort of, well, there are kind of success stories, people who have made a go of it on their own, but sometimes, you know, even teams, understandably, they will kind of turn up their nose or sort of furrow their brow at the idea that you're just kind of an individual creator, you don't belong to a big media company, and they don't really know how to kind of, how to take that, they don't know how to sort of gauge your impact, your audience and whatever. But do you think there is a, there is, when sort of 5-10 years from now, there'll be a lot of creators, journalists like you working in cycling?
Yeah, and I think there were definitely before me. Like, if you look at, you know, enterprises like, you know, whether it's in podcast format, whether it's YouTube, you know, Lantern Rouge, a number of others out there too, you know, working a regular freelance beat across multimedia kind of entities. You know, I don't think that's anything new. I think it's getting harder and harder for, you know, in inverted quotes, legacy titles. And I definitely think that's been the trend since early 2010s, maybe. I mean, I definitely, you know, we talked for ages about how, you know, budget cuts and staff redundancies have affected titles for well over a decade, and not just in cycling, obviously. I think it's getting harder and harder from that format. And I think, like, being diverse and maybe having a little bit of a niche, I think definitely helps you. What happens in the next 3 or 4 years, I've got no idea. I mean, you see launches that are, you know, powered by AI, and that's going to obviously creep in more and more with titles over the next few years. And yeah, there's lots to say on that too. But yeah, all I can talk about is like the next 12 months, because I don't even know what Substack's going to be like in, you know, 2 years or 3 years, or what I'll be doing. But I know that I'm, you know, looking ahead to 2026 and keep on going with Substack and, yeah, putting out a story or two stories a day for the next 12 months. So, yeah, I don't really have like a long-term vision on that, but it's definitely, if you look at the trend over the last 5-6 years, it's definitely becoming tougher and tougher out there for media outlets.
Dan, finally, how do people find your Substack?
Google, or just Google my name, Daniel Benson, Cycling Substack, or on Twitter, DNL Benson. Thank you very much for the plug, by the way. Or just dnlbenson.substack.com. And yeah, that's the easiest way to find me, Twitter or just through the World Wide Web.
Excellent. And of course, we have our own Substack, cycling podcast, Substack, the 1101 Cappuccino. Dan, I'm going to leave you to, well, run amok in the Little Czech Media Day. Just one final thing I would like to mention, or need to mention. Christmas is coming, as we know, and as most years, we have got together with our friends at Divine Cellars, the wine retailer in London, to offer our best of the Grand Tours 2025 case. Of course, we do cases for all three Grand Tours, but some wines don't make the cut. You can find that, UK listeners can find and order that going on to the Divine Cellars. That's the letter D, then Vine. Sellers.com. On their website, you will find the cycling podcast cases, including the best of 2025. Dan, thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again at some point in the future.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Byrne.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.